I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening, thank you for subscribing, thank you for downloading, and you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. This podcast is at the Rugby Dungeon, and you can find me, Tim and Phil, every Monday morning on Egg Chasers at Rugby Podcast on Twitter. But now I have Gloss's Director of Rugby and all-round good guy, Johan Ackerman. Enjoy. Hey, hi, Johan, how are you?
Fine, and you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for doing this.
No problem, man.
I've been looking forward to doing this for an awful long time. Is this true? Were you a shooting instructor for the police?
Yeah. After my school career, I went to the police, and then my training, they asked, I applied to be a musketry, a shooting instructor in the college, and then I had to do the course there, and then when I passed, I did it for a number of years. I was the shooting instructor there at the police college in Pretoria.
That's incredible. So how long were you a shooting instructor, and how long were you a rugby player, and what were you doing both at the same time?
Yeah, I did both in the same time. We trained in the afternoons or evenings, and from early morning 6-7 was busy doing training with the young and new recruits, policemen. Had a full day with them, and then in the afternoon train. And I joined the police force in 88. I became a shooting instructor in 89, and I left the police in 1999. So it's about 11 years. Yeah, just close to 11 years I was in the police.
Wow. So why did you leave then?
What happened is, obviously, after South Africa won the World Cup in 95, 96, there was the big thing with Francois Pienaar and the Springbok group and the Murdoch thing. And that's when Super Rugby and the professional in South Africa really started, and contracts started for the first time. So end of 99, beginning of 2000, I received a contract from the Lions in Johannesburg. So what happened is I had to drive either early morning or in the afternoon for training, and that meant I missed half of the day at the police college where the training is happening. And it's like anything in life, people was not happy that I'm working there. But in that year, early in the 90s and stuff, you know, the police still saw it as a bit of a marketing ploy. But then later on, they felt they can't pay me a full salary if I'm not there half of the days. So I made the big decision to resign from the police and go full time with the rugby that I played basically from 2000 till 2007-08 when I retired.
Wow. So do you think there's much synergy between training police and training rugby players?
Yeah, I think like anything in life, you learn, obviously part of the course, apart from learning about the weapons and the shooting and stuff, you learn how to, the first month or two, or basically it's a year training before you become and that you have to obviously pass certain things to become an instructor or in the police college. And part of that is you learn a bit about how to present and how to do, you know, classes and how to talk to people and a bit of education on teaching people. So I think, in a sense, it definitely helped. It gave you that ability to stand in front of people and how to talk and stuff. And not like I would say I'm the best with that, but I'm still saying it gave you a bit of background. And then obviously you had to work with pelotons of 36 per peloton of police officers. And I've played also and interchange with some of those guys that played with you, and you learn how to have that mutual respect between you in daytime, you the sergeant, you in control, and then on the rugby field, you know, they're your teammates, and I think it learns you a bit of relationships, you know, how to handle relationships on different levels. So I think it definitely had a bit of a transparency over to coaching.
Yeah, I guess also if you're a firearms instructor, that gives you a lot of leeway to be, well, I guess quite nice, because you've got a gun. You know that's the ultimate form of expression.
Yeah, well, we had the license, you know, we couldn't, obviously safety was priority, so we were quite strict on that, but we had the license to if we feel they didn't do the job well enough, to obviously make them run and make them do a bit of PT and a bit of hard work. So that was nice. We had that you had that power, but I mean, ultimately it was about getting them well trained and well prepared for what they need to do if they go out on the streets.
Yeah. So have I got my time frame right here? You must have been a very young instructor.
Yeah. I was 19 years old. I was 19 years old. David, just give me 1 second.
Yeah,
sorry.
Of course.
Sorry, I was just a good neighbor by receiving an Amazon packet for somebody, and he wanted it now. So my parents put me early in school, so I finished school at the age of 17, my final year, and I was in the police at 18, do my own training, and obviously, like I just said, and the age of 19, I qualified to become an instructor, so I was young, yes.
And how did the older officers treat you? Because I imagine that there's some pretty hardened South African police officers out there.
No, I mean, during your training, you obviously get hard, you know, they're hard on you, and especially, you know, obviously any training, if you go to the army or whatever, any basic training is hard, but after you pass out with your basic training and you apply for the different divisions, I obviously applied for the musketry one, and then I got approved, and then I went in that training. And for 6 months, you know, you do all the ugly work, and you obviously learn a lot from those officers and senior sergeants and senior warrant officers and stuff. But eventually, once you've, you know, got your passing out and you do take your first classes, they always will be on the background helping you for a period of time. You're almost like a bit of a attendee always. And then after that, you know, you obviously earn that respect, but there's always a respect, you know. I mean, if they've got 10, 15, 20 years of experience above you, you will always respect that. And there's the odd days that they, if you do make a mistake, they'll come hard down on you. But, you know, I think like anything in life, everything builds into one's discipline and character and everything. So all was not bad. A lot of things was good. And you learn how to respect, authority.
What gets the heart rate going more, international rugby or police work?
No, the rugby was always the love, you know. I mean, if it wasn't for the police, I would have probably stopped the rugby. I mean, I didn't play any high level at school or for in South Africa. You know, Craven Week is a big provincial competition for school kids. And normally, if you don't play that, you don't play for SA schools, you don't play for SA under-20s, and normally you just go into a normal day job. In those years, in the late 80s, 90s, the police was one avenue for you to go and play, because the government was still strong in sport. I came into the police college. There was thousands of young men who wanted to play the game. And eventually I ended up in the A team for the under 20 league. And I thought to myself, you see, maybe if I take it a bit serious. And through the fact that I played for the police under 20 side, I obviously got almost seen by the senior coaches of the police team. And that those years, the South African police rugby team would probably had about 8 to 9 provincial players who played for the Bulls. That's how strong they were.
And, wow.
You know, and the we would have played against the likes of Joost van der Westhuizen, who played for Tuckies, and club rugby in those years. If you didn't play for provincial rugby, that only started late in March, because there was no super rugby in 1991-92 in those years. You play club rugby on a Friday night, there will be 15 to 20,000 people watching two clubs play each other, because there's half of the teams will be Springboks or provincial players. So the police gave me that step in the door to become a player and then obviously be seen as I play against other opposition, and that's why I made my first provincial start for the you guys will know them as the Bulls, the Blue Bulls.
Yeah.
And that's why, because they were, that's where I was stationed in the police in Pretoria.
Yeah, so the police actually in the UK have got a fairly rich history of professional rugby players. I can think of Martin Bay, just off the top of my head, it's Martin Bayfield. I think Tim Rodber, he was a soldier. Dorian West was a policeman, I think, for a bit of time. Who was the other one? Dean Richards was famously a policeman too.
Yeah, and I saw the other day the defence game at Twickenham. You know, there was it was quite intense, the defence against the Navy, and there was a few guys playing in that game, and I think Rokonanguni played at Bath. So I mean that's obviously we were fortunate that it was a strong club, and obviously now that things have changed with professional rugby. There's not a lot of players that play at club level anymore. You know, the only avenue now, if you don't get recruited from school by the provincial sides, you probably I don't know if you're aware, but in South Africa there's a big tournament between January and April. They call it the Varsity Cup. It's all our top universities that play each other, and that's probably the one avenue still for you. If you haven't, let's say, got a break at school, if you go and study, you can maybe get through that and get an opportunity.
Now, if you think about the boys that you have and you're working with every day, and obviously being a professional rugby player now is bloody difficult. You know, it's a very, very tough sport to get into and to reach the top. But do you think that we're missing out something, not having guys like yourself who have gone and done other things, you know, even for a few years before coming into professional rugby, a different sort of skill set or you know, mindset, I guess?
Yeah, I've always thought about that, you know. I think the reality is I don't know if it will ever happen, but I do believe that between 18 and 19 or 18 and 20, a one-year kind of basic training level kind of course, where you just learn a bit about, you know, working with other people, working maybe in a bit of a pressure environment, a bit of discipline, can always help players. Also, you know, thinking if during that year, maybe if they can, you know, almost like a gap year where there's people coming in and learn to, more about you and try and help you. What's your apart from rugby? What's your other interest? Because I think the reality is nobody knows at 18, 19. I was just fortunate that, you know, there was only three avenues for you in South Africa. You either go and study, or you go to the army, or you go to the police. I mean, those years, you know, people didn't, in my group as a white male, there was not a lot of people with their own businesses. And the reality was, army was compulsory. And if I didn't go to the police, I applied for the police and I got approved. If I didn't go there, I would have done my 2 years in the army, and I know there's, you know, I don't think 2 years you have to do it, but I think that if there's a kind of process where young players or young men that finish school do go do something, I think it can add to them. But I understand, you know, things has moved on, and you know, especially in rugby, I think the reality is that after school, the clubs or the people that's going to pay that person that they want to invest in him, they want to get hands on him, they want to put them in their program to develop their skills, to develop them physically, and you're probably going to lose out on that if they're not under your control for a year or so.
Yeah, it's a very difficult one, because I actually think, particularly with tight five forwards, because they don't really mature until a lot older than, say, a scrum half or a winger or whatnot. There is a sort of a time there where they could go out and do something else, but the risk of not being picked up afterwards, it's just too great to take that risk.
Yeah, no, for sure. I agree 100%. You know, the patience on late developers, I mean, that's a crucial part in today's game. And if you know that there's a program that they can go into and do something else, but keep up to date with their skills, and then as they mature, then later get the opportunity back. But I don't know the schools as well in the UK, but in South Africa, the talent is of such that if you don't get into the program, or if you don't get into a provincial side on an early age, your chances of getting back into it later is very slim. As for one, you know, obviously there's nothing that is really sustainable. There's a few academies that like the Sharks Academy is probably the best one in the country where they can go to, and even though they haven't got, obviously the father will pay or whatever, and the parent will pay, and then doing that 2 or 3 year course where he studies, he gets the very good coaching, and he gets very good physical development. Mm. And a guy like Marcel Kutsia, for example, is probably the and I think even Beast is probably the two best examples. They came to the academy. Nobody knows of them. The parents paid, or they, B's case, I think he came from Zimbabwe. Somebody paid for him, and as they were there, the academy just trained against the senior team. And as they trained against them, somebody said, "Who's this back rower who's so good?" And then they said, "No, this is a guy who played in a small little school in Durban, and it was Marcel Kutsia." And in a year, He played for the Sharks, and then he got his first professional contract. So,
that's incredible.
But other than that, you know, it's a tough environment. There's not really a lot of avenues, and I do believe between, like we just said, 18 and 23, 18 and 24, a lot of players that's maybe the second team or not being signed by the clubs, but they are good players. They need only 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then they actually become men. You know, they actually develop into the better player. And I think we will be amazed if one could have kept every player involved, how many other players would have probably overtaken the stars of the schools.
Well, I mean, there's always the case when you talk to any player, really, and you ask them, who was the best player that you played with? It's very seldom themselves. There's always someone who was equally as good, who just never quite made it.
Yeah, and I mean, some kids, unfortunately, is phenomenal at school, and then 2 years later, you know, what they had at school is not good enough anymore, but they had the break, and they maybe had the contract to move on, and then somebody that probably had more potential never got the opportunity. So I mean, that's sport. I was fortunate to listen to Arsene Wenger a year ago before he left Arsenal, and they invited all the Premiership head coaches, and went up and listened at the stadium there, and he spoke, and he said, they're recruiting between 14 and 17 or 18 or something like that. And if he hasn't made it by 19, they believe he won't make it as a professional.
Wow.
And we were amazed because, there's so many rugby players that become good rugby players only when they're 23, 24, 25, you know. And it shows you how, you know, obviously how the two sports different, but again, you know, it's a rat race of talent, and everybody pick and hope they get the right ones.
Well, one of the best redemption stories that I know of, it's actually one of your players. Do you know Mark Atkinson's history?
I've heard a lot about it, yes. I've heard he's been all over and, you know, obviously been in a fair bit, not been recognised and get the recognition he got and the opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, he's moved positions, moved clubs. He's been, you know, to Sedgley Park, down to Bedford Blues, and then Gloucester picked him up and, you know, absolutely flying now. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Late developers. And I'm astonished at that football quote. I guess it must be down to the physicality of rugby or some such thing.
Yeah, they felt they can see the technical skills of the guy. And if he hasn't got it by 19, they feel they can't develop it further. How he's going to handle or the speed with the ball or something like that, he explained. And all the coaches, obviously, we all were amazed because I've picked up guys at the Lions that haven't even played at a high level, but I was, somebody whispered in my ear, come and watch this guy playing for a club, and I go and watch, and then we like what we see potentially and invite him for a training or two, and then eventually you know, he gets a contract. So I think there's definitely a different you can definitely get rapid players that can develop at a later stage. I don't think that's as fair, but I don't know if every club has got that view, but it's interesting how they felt that if you're not at 19, haven't got certain abilities and awareness of space, that you will struggle as a footballer to get it.
Incredible stuff. Now, I know obviously you roll in Gloucester slightly different, so you roll in the Lions, but did you spend quite a lot of time at the Lions scouting and standing by sides of pitches watching unknown players?
Yeah, it was a bit different from here because obviously the situation was a bit different with the Lions. Because I took over the year they were out of Super Rugby, and we lost a lot of players to other provincial sides and players who went overseas. So when we got back in Super Rugby in 2014, our budget was limited, our sponsors was limited, and then we obviously had to get players from within the region, but also from in South Africa, and that's when I got a number of players that was not recognized, or call it not re-signed by the provinces, and the likes of Ruan Janssen van Rensburg and Faf and and Franco Mostert and Kortnos Kosan and Warwick Tecklenburg is all guys played in the 2016 final for me and became Springboks and those guys. And it's, you know, one, I thought it's they had the potential. And then we picked up one or two players that we went and watched at clubs and just saw potential in them. And the one is Jacques van Rooy, and he played at Bath last year.
Yeah.
He played...
The
prop, yeah. Yes. So I mean, we had to go and scout all over. You know, one of our locks, Lawrence Erasmus, is playing in Japan now. I saw him playing for the school that my son played in, and he didn't get any offer from any club, and I went
good
to
God.
You know, so yeah. So I mean, like I said, I had to watch a lot of rugby and because of searching for players, but then again, we were fortunate that that a few names came around our desk from other places that didn't want them, and it worked out for us well. But it was a bit different, yeah. So I haven't been watching as much club rugby. Yeah, I've been watching obviously a few games where Hartbury plays Jersey or some local teams or whatever. And keep watching the talent, but it's a bit different, yeah, where you've got a group and you just slot it in.
Yeah, do you think it's different over here because of the sheer amount of games that you've got to play?
Yeah, I mean, it is different, yeah, but also I think the awareness of the players back home is a bit easier, so we get, because our schools is so competitive and so well organized, and there's different competitions for the schools that get televised etc. Your access to play, so you become aware of the young talent that comes through, and you're aware of players playing in your region that maybe was good at school that moved on to a club. You're a bit more aware of those names than, yeah, you know, obviously, yeah, you like I just said, you get the squad.
Yeah.
I came and I get the squad, and then you know, it's so competitive environment that there's not really time for developing, and then so you fill it up with names like we did, sign in maybe some players locally, or like Matt Bannon or whatever, or Fraser or Ed Slater come in, or you get them from overseas. So it's almost like, you know, you walking into this highly competitive competition, and you have to have a decent squad to compete. And obviously, we're going to rely a lot on our academy now going forward to recruit good talent and to get school kids in and develop them for the future.
That's incredible. So let me just so I know I'm right here. What was your mandate with the Lions? Did they just say, Johan, we've got a team coming up. You need to populate it with good players. And then following that, you must have been amazed by some of these players that they were giving you that nobody else wanted. It must have been astonishing to get from Rendsburg.
I was amazed that obviously with some of the names, they were probably, to be fair to the Bulls and to some of the places, they were probably spoiled with quality players. You know, you can only have so much players on your books. You know, and they were spoiled with really good talent. And like I just said, if you've got, say, four good midfielders and you know all the potential is there for one to come through, but you haven't got the finance to keep him, or you can't almost satisfy him, you can't promise him any game time, you know, you probably have to cut your losses and say we can't give you a contract. And I think that's where we were fortunate that those players probably were still second, third and fourth choice, where they were a bit vulnerable, that they know they either not going to get a contract, or that even if they re-sign, they probably only going to play two or three games for the season. And that obviously put us in a stronger position, but to get them, because we were rebuilding a squad. We had no big names. There was opportunity for them to come and to be the number one. So that made it a bit easier.
Now, I imagine this is exactly what you did, but I'll let you tell me. There must have been some kind of mindset within that group that nobody wants us, therefore let's go and win the South African Conference and ultimately get to the final of Super Rugby, right?
No, I think that we never made it official discussion, but I definitely felt that that was a driving thing for the players, you know, speaking to them why they wanted to come to the Lions, speaking to them what was their goals. They said they just want the opportunity to show everybody that they can develop and can play at the highest level. So the hunger was there, the desire, and I think I want to say in the back in their minds, and probably back in the drive of the team, there was a bit of a motivation to say, okay, we are a group that only came together now. We are a group that some of us were not good enough to get contracted where we were. So we're going to work hard together. We're going to play for each other and try and establish that. So it definitely helped us from a coaching point of view to make them work hard and to chase their success that they wanted to achieve.
It's just occurred to me, you were such a new team, or with so many new personnel, how do you get them playing with such cohesion? Because that's what I always think about when I think about the Lions, particularly in the run-up to their Super Rugby final. The style of rugby play and the rugby played, and the cohesion in which they played with.
Yeah, I mean, it was a process, JB. To be honest, I mean, it was a process of that we went through in 2013 and 14, developing how do we want to be perceived as a team. And I would say Swayze the Brain joined me from the Sharks, and you know, he had a vision of how he wanted to play, and I said to him that, you know, what I want to play, and we're all with JP Ferraro, who's now at Munster, the defence coach. We all were new, and we all were exciting. And then we said, and then we obviously went and we had a plan to play to it. But then I had a very interesting discussion with Dave Rennie about, you know, how his vision is at the Chiefs and stuff. And then we went back and we sat and Swayze was, you know, but now we've got an opportunity as well to just express ourselves. And we sat and we said, okay, to the group, well, the style, if we want to change the style of how we're going to perceive ourselves, we look at our player team profile, we look at the players we've got, that none of our pack, for example, we never had the biggest pack, but we had players, the Warren Whiteleys, the Franco Mosterts, the guys who can really run for 80 minutes. And we said, okay, so let's change our player profile. Let's become one of the teams that stretches the teams and make use of the ball. And then it was obviously time and hard, a lot of hard work from all the coaches to get the skill up to the level of playing that brand. And we were spoiled with Alice Park, was a, you know, 90% of the games is in perfect condition and it's at altitude. So if we fit, we could have run teams that they struggle.
Yeah, I guess that's almost like the perfect storm, which is if you've got the lads who want to prove themselves and they're naturally hardworking because of that, you guys can simply concentrate on skills and, you know, you can afford to play rugby like the rugby that you played.
Yeah, I mean, and we gave the players a lot of freedom. And if I say freedom, I mean, it's not like there wasn't a basic structure and players didn't know how we're going to attack from this left-hand, right-hand scrum or this line-out. There was a basic. We obviously looked at the opposition and saw weaknesses that we wanted to play to. But, I mean, that was the big strength of Swayze as well, to really hone the players' individual skills to make good decisions and to say, okay, when are we going to offload? If we're going to have this running game, we can't afford to knock every second ball and have a good passing skills as forwards and backs. So, and that's what I mean with hard work. Apart from the normal work in the gym and the fitness, the players had that freedom to express themselves, to go out of structure if they see their space, you know. And Elton Yankees or Faf, whoever, they weren't robotic to say, oh, we have to play this three phases. If in the second phase something open up, and then they can exploit it, they can do it. So there was good synergy between the coaches, what we want, what the players want, and obviously there was a belief in from both sides that what we how we present the plan for the week and they bought into it. And vice versa, the trust that they will execute it, but and then we can trust them on the decisions they make on the field. So it was just we obviously leadership was an important thing, and Warren Whiteley must get a lot of credit. Yeah, how he led the team, and you know how he just galvanized the players as well. So we had a psychologist that really got the team on the same page of thinking under pressure and just playing playing with the right attitude, etc. So you know it was really a lot of effort from a lot of people, it is a process. And I think like any organization, if one are happy and you want to be there where you are, then although you
tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Work hard, you still will do it with a smile on your face.
Did any of your success with the Lions surprise you?
No, for sure. I mean, I won't lie, the fact that I just became a coach and in 2010 I was my assistant coach for the first time and my first coaching opportunity, and I mean, in 2013 I became a head coach, and that was quite soon. And then the reality is, 3 years later, we played in a Super Rugby final. That all surprised me, you know, and just again the situation that we were. I think if we had 2013 a team already established with 10 or 12 or 13 Springboks in, and maybe I had two or three experienced assistant coaches, I would have said, okay, no, that's fair. But I was in my first Super Rugby. Swayze got back into coaching. He was 11 years only running as the Shark Academy manager. My defense coach was the previous coach, technical analyst, so I gave him his first coaching opportunity and stuff. So we were all new, and therefore, you know. But I mean, to be fair, I mean, there was a big belief, and if I say belief, you know, we trusted that God has put us on this path together as a group of men, and He really blessed us with just almost, I want to say, the people at the right time to get the best out of the team.
Well, I mean, if I look at your career through the Lions through to Gloucester now, some might say that you are blessed. I mean, you must look back and think, this coaching malarkey is relatively easy.
No, trust me, my wife won't say that if she looks at my nails and at the stress I'm going through sometimes. No, but I mean, it's, I really grateful that it went so well, and that God is really blessing me, and I thank Him for His grace and wisdom and guidance. But the reality is, JB, is that it's because it's people that you work with, you know. The rugby is important for me, but at the end of the day, I want to know that I've treated everybody with respect and treated everybody well. And that's the most important thing for me wherever I go. You know, if I can achieve that, I'll be more than happy. Apart from playing in finals or winning anything, that's the most important thing for me.
So what made you want to leave the Lions? And not so much, because I don't suppose you wanted to leave the Lions as such. What made the Gloucester proposition so attractive?
It was a difficult one, I must be honest with you. It felt like we ticking all the boxes, everything is going well, everybody is happy. The Lions are happy, the sponsors are happy. You almost, you know, got everything smoothed out, and then suddenly this opportunity came and you got a year left on your contract, and I was signed for 2018 as well with the Lions, and I thought, why now? Why will this opportunity come? And my daughter was still at school, and I sat down and I obviously discussed it with my wife, but also with people that I trust always out of rugby, and I thought to myself, you know, there was always a feeling that somewhere that, you know, everybody is getting opportunities. The players started to get opportunities to go overseas. Some of the coaches got opportunities. And we always said, you know, we don't know how long this, call it, unique situation is going to be where we can stay together as a team and as a as a group of management. And then after I met with Martin and with David, when I heard about the, well, when they approached me about the, that Gloucester is looking for a coach, it's probably that the fact that they told me that the club is hungry. There's a group of players that's hungry to work hard and hungry to succeed and stuff. And I thought, you know, this is probably a good thing for me to leave the Lions in a place where they, you know, maybe in a year or 2 years' time, the five or six or seven players do move on, and we probably won't go as bad as it were, but you're in a rebuilding phase again. And like anything in life, if you struggle, then people will say, okay, no, so now it's a whole process again.
Yeah.
So I just felt, you know, let me be the one guy that give this Lions team that's in a good place to somebody who can carry on with it. And he's got a good team. He's got a financially the Lions is in a good place where instead of where it were. And I just felt that I had this peace in me that the job is done there. You know, I saw young men became married men and became matured men and people that were good men off the field. And I felt the job was done. And I didn't know what I'm walking into at Gloucester's, but the fact that they said it's a rugby town. It's a passionate rugby supporters. It's a club that, you know, has got a rich history and stuff. That attracted me, that I felt, let me come. And if there's ever opportunity to walk away from a Lions, let me come to a club that, you know, is almost similar to what I used to.
And what was your first impression of Gloucester, both as a town and a club, when you arrived? Because it's much different to Johannesburg.
Yeah, well... Joburg is quite unique, but I mean, I love it. You know, it's obviously, like I said, everything is smaller in the sense the stadium is smaller, but it's intimate. You know, the supporters are close to you. They vocal. They passionate. They sound like a 10,000 crowd. Yeah, sounds, you know, much harder than a 20 or 30,000 crowd at Ellis Park. So, you know, they vocal their passion, they follow the team. And it's a great town for me personally because I had to get up in the mornings early to miss traffic. I lived in Pretoria and it was an hour's drive for me. Now it's 15 minutes, you know, and 10 minutes, 15 minutes to Hartbury where we train, but 10 minutes from the house to the stadium. So it's just brilliant, and I just, you know, love the fact that the town is so behind the team, and the stadium is beautiful. So enjoyed so far every moment.
Yeah. Now I'm just I'm trying to think how to ask this. Well, I've been lucky enough to ask you questions twice before, both at Sale Sharks after games, and I've got to say, after both times of asking you questions, I actually thought I'd quite like to play for Johan Ackerman because you've got that sort of that sort of gravitas about you, I guess. Is that something which comes naturally, or do you work on how to get players to want to play for you and how to be liked as an individual?
No, you know, that's a difficult one. I don't see myself that way. I just want to, what you see is what you get, you know. I'm very open with. I don't like secrets. I try to be as honest as I can with people, and I'm, you know, just like I said, I love to have fun, and I love to treat people, you know, the way I wanted to be treated. So, and I think the players will hopefully see my heart then that I want the best for them, but also they must understand that I want you to commit. If you there, you know, want you to, that we will have fun and enjoyment. But when we're on the field and when there's expectation that you as an individual must work hard, then you'll do that, because then I'll fight for you and try and give you the best.
Yeah, because I mean, you're obviously a very popular man within the squad. How then do you deal when you've got to have unpopular decisions and you've got to make sure that those unpopular decisions have got to be relayed to a player? Because obviously that's a different side to you that they don't see on a day-to-day basis, but you know, issues have to be addressed.
Yeah, I think there is times that you have to be firm and assertive of things that you're not happy with, but I feel the days of shouting and screaming and stuff is gone. I think there's ways how to get your message over and yet make it quite clear that it's not acceptable and unfortunately you have to do it, in certain situations. But that's why I say where the players have to understand that honesty, that when things are not going well and you have to be honest about that you're not happy with whatever the situation is, that you will share it with them. And in the back of my mind, I think you do believe to have that a bit of, you know, we all, that empathy. I think that's the advantage probably I had by playing the game for a long time, is that, you know, I know, depending on what the situation is, nobody does something on purpose, especially not in a rugby sense. And if you can understand that, then hopefully that will control your message. But you have to sometimes, you know, obviously, be, like I said, be strict and be, make it quite clear that you're not happy with something.
Now, I don't know this for certain, but I'm guessing when you were a player, there wasn't a coach like you coaching yourself. Do you look back at that and think things could have been done differently, or am I completely wrong there?
I've learned the bits from coaches, parts of stuff that you that formed and learned that you, and that you remember what you thought of certain situations, definitely. But I then again, exactly what you say. I think there's definitely times that I think it would have been nice if the coaches then that coached me or whatever would have think differently or treated us differently or did stuff differently as what I would have liked to do it now.
If you don't mind me asking this now, I was reading about you, and obviously I've got a certain image of yourself both through meeting you at Sale and also through our conversation now and your general TV demeanour. You actually got yourself in a bit of hot water with a drugs ban back in your playing days. Do you mind if I just ask you about that and how it came about?
Yeah, so what happened is I played for the Springboks in 96, and in my fourth test I tore my knee ligaments, and then I had an operation a few days later, and the doctor said to me, it's about 3 months, then I'll be 3 to 4 months maximum, then I'll be back on the field and ready to go. And obviously it was a big disappointment so early in my Springbok career to get this injury, and it was physically just about a week or two before, or a couple of weeks before the All Blacks came to South Africa for a three-test series. It was the last series ever from an All Black team. From there on, it would only be in the one or the two tests for championships. It was, you know, before that, normally the All Blacks came every second or third year for a best out of three series. And I missed that, and they were obviously very disappointed and quite desperate to know, you know, the taste of international rugby and playing for the Springboks. And then I started with my rehab on my knee, and that was on the 3rd of August. I got injured in 96, and then August went past, September went past, October went past, November came, and that was the 4 months, and I still couldn't straighten my knee, couldn't put any real weights on my knee on the leg machine and stuff. It was very painful and stuff. And then I did my rehab and a lot of my weight training in the police college. And there was a bioneticist, like a strength and conditioner guy who does all the injured police officers that get injured during duty. He did all the rehabilitation for them. And he told me, he looked at my knee and he said to me, listen, The only reason why your knee is still painful is the fact that the muscle on the inside, if you flex your knee or your leg, the muscle on the inside is completely gone. You know, it's like there's no muscle, and that muscle keeps your knee in line, and because your knee is not in line, that's the pain, etc. So he gave me, he explained to me everything, and he said to me, and I said to him, but it's 4 months, you know, and how do I get it back? And he said to me, okay, the only thing you can do is I'll give you a steroid injection, and then you strain the knee, and hopefully with that the muscle will come back, and that will eventually end up with your pain gone. And I said, well, okay. And he said to me, okay, are you playing now? And I said, no, I got the season is done. Even in South Africa, the season is done. It's only the Springboks that's going to go on the end of year tour, but Currie Cup, everything is done. I'm not playing. If my knee is healthy and fit, my first game will be end of February with the 97 Super Rugby starts. And he said, oh, no, that's no problem. This is November now. By January, you'll be fine if they do do testing, because it will be out of your system. And I said, okay. And he gave me an injection, and I started to train. Come January, end of January, beginning of February, I got a call from the Springbok manager and said that there's a Springbok training camp. They want to test all the players' fitness and strength, just to see where they are before the Super Rugby kicks off. It's all done in Cape Town. I got on the plane, got there, and we did all the testing. But funny enough, JB, and that's the disappointing part, is that it didn't even help. That one injection didn't even help, because come end of January, I still couldn't run. I still couldn't do leg weights. I could do a little bit more than what I could, but I still had a lot of pain. I couldn't do anything. So we got there. I did the pull-ups, the bench press, did my fat, the body calm, all that. But I couldn't do the running test, and I couldn't do the squat test, obviously, because of my knee. And then as we finished the day, the doctor of the Springbok said, listen, you guys must all just do a quick urine test. We just want to test it for how you guys are on all the different stuff in your urine that you need, iron, I don't know, whatever thing, and then we're going to do a drug test. So I thought, do I tell them, or do I believe that what that guy said, it's out? And I thought to myself, no, man, it's so informal. The test is done so informal. You take your cups on your own time. You go to the toilet on your own time. I'll be fine. It's not that serious. So I went to the toilet. I did the urine in the cups, and or in the whatever things you tubs, and I took it back. And then obviously they tested it for enhancing stuff, and then a week later they phoned me, and my phone rang, and I picked it up, and they said, listen, this is the Springbok doctor. I said, yes, we've got a problem. You have tested positive. And it, you know, obviously it was the most horrible feeling in my life, knowing that I'm going to get suspended for 2 years and lose a lot of financial stuff, but also most importantly or worst lose, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 caps and probably a lot of my Springbok career.
Yeah, you must have been. I guess in today's society, we're very, very judgmental, probably much more so than people were then. But regardless, when you got that phone call, you must have been absolutely devastated.
Yeah, I was upset with myself. I was upset with the misguidance I got from a person that you think will know, you know, work with people that can help you. I was upset with, I felt the disgrace that, you know, I know people is going to judge me and think I became a Springbok, that I've used stuff before. I've obviously felt horrible towards my wife and the disappointment she has to face, and then now I had to sell my house. I had to move back to a police house. Obviously, that's a bit cheaper than the than the house I had, and I had to sell a car, my car. And so it was, you know, so it was a very humbling experience, and obviously a lot of people had a lot to say. It's only your true friends that stayed with you, and people that, that you only realize who your true friends are. And that, it, in a sense, it, it, you know, it, it, it was a dark place in my life, because I was cross for the world. I you know, took it out. I became stupid thing socially by, you know, drink a lot and do stupid stuff, and my wife had to suffer through that. And then, but eventually, you know, again, like I said, God had a plan, and he got me back. And when I got the opportunity to play at the Lions, you know, I didn't know after 2 years if I will play again. But you know, thanks to Doc Late and Laurie Mains, they got me back in there, and I started to play. And then my main drive was, I said, if I can only put the jersey, the Springbok jersey, over my head one more time, that will be like the you know, the best thing ever, just to show people I didn't need any drugs to play at that level. And you know, thanks, it was, thank to God's grace, I played another 8 times for the Springboks after that. So yeah, so I was fortunate, or 9 times, whatever. So I was really was a tough time, but you know, it was all forming to me. With a lot of other wrong decisions I made, and a lot of other injuries I had, and a lot of other setbacks where coaches didn't pick me or whatever, it one don't realize it, but it formed me. You know, it formed me who I am, and it added to my life experience that I can sit with the players if they come in my office, and I can relate with them. You know, and I can share with them, and hopefully. I can't always make them feel 100% better, but hopefully we can all learn a bit from what we've all experienced.
Who was it hardest to break the news to?
My wife. Yeah, I had to drive to her to the new house that I just bought.
Ugh.
And I had to tell her that I had a phone call, and that I'm probably going to get suspended, and that means that, you know, my contract will be null and void and cancelled and stuff, and that we probably have to sell the house. So that was quite tough. It was quite an emotional evening.
I can only imagine. Do you know, when you look at the players now, I mean, obviously you were well looked after as a Springbok, and you were well paid for what you did. But obviously the money in rugby is growing more and more and more. Do you, bearing in mind what you went through, do you have more understanding for the lads who find themselves at the wrong end of this temptation to take a shortcut? Because the riches on offer now in rugby, I mean, they're just going to get greater and greater.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's a lot of temptations out there. I mean, obviously... The players has to be so careful because of social media and all those things, and especially if you're injured. I think the biggest challenge now, I don't think players will take a chance if they're playing where they want to play, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
If they play for Gloucester, if they play for Northampton, if they play for the Lions, for the Stormers, I think they won't. And for the international sides, I think they won't be that naive to take something. But it's just under that. It's when they, and that under 20 level, when they're at school, I think there's a, you know, South Africa's, there's a, I think the school kids there, I think is definitely looking at their heroes, looking at their stars that they look up to, and they want to look the same physically. And then obviously that when there's injuries, the players lose so much money if they're injured, and if they not get back on the pitch, and they don't, you know, some of the players got maybe incentives if they play certain amount of games, and also you know if you're injured and and it's a long-term injury, 6 months, you think you're not going to be tested, and you think, well, that guy who's taking my position, I need to be better than him when I come back. So I think all that temptations is definitely, but, you know, my only advice is run away, you know. Don't even go there, because it's not worth it if, you know, maybe 10 guys can get away with it, but one guy, if you're the unlucky one, is not going to get away with it. And I think we saw now what happened with Apiwe Dejante, you know.
Yes, of course.
Last year he was up and coming.
Was he with you at the Lions?
He was. He didn't play for me. Personally, he was. We knew about him, and in my last year before I left, we invited him to a couple of trainings to train with us. We saw he's playing really well for University of Joburg. But as I left that, he trained for, like I said, he trained with us. But we had Cornel Skosan, we had Ruan Kombrink. Our wingers were in form and playing for the Springboks then. So, but then as I left that following year, 2018, that's when Swayze really pulled him in, and he became a Springbok in the same year, plus Player of the Year. You know,
I was lucky enough to meet him in Monaco when he won Young Player of the Year. Yeah. An outstanding young man, and it's such a shame that, I mean, hopefully there'll be a reasonable excuse for it or something. Hopefully he is young enough to bounce back from it, but a very impressive young man.
But again, he's a great guy. But again, wrong advice. Apparently they suspected his stuff that he used and by his sponsor supplements. And again, I blame the supplement company that sponsored him to not be 100% sure. That's why I say, so the players must be so careful with what they get sponsored with and what they get advice from, and obviously rather use the stuff that from the clubs, because that is certified and approved, and then you've got a backup if something happened that you only use that. But at the moment I think the temptations, hopefully the players will turn their backs on that.
How do you rebuild a reputation after something like that has happened?
Yeah, well, I was fortunate, and it took, obviously, like I said, a lot of hard work and a lot of grace, and I got back in 2001 when I played for the Springboks again. You know, I had a lot of support, and over the years, obviously, like anything in life, there's other stories and other things that take over, and life move on, and people, you know, I never really had any problems. People invited me all over the country, and I was treated well, and I think hopefully I've proved myself over the years playing in South Africa and stuff, I'm not shy about the lessons I've learned to share that, and it's something I can't hide, you know. Therefore, I have to live with that. But the reality is, I think my kids suffered a little bit as a consequence, because as Ruan grew up in school, that's the sad thing, is that the kids he plays against at under 14, under 15, under 16 level, he will walk off the field. And then he said to me, we told him at an early age, so they know, so it was not a secret. But he will say, that Lock or that guy, as he tackled me, he said to me, your dad is a steroid user, or your dad
of
is this, or your dad
did.
Is that. And I mean, I think by myself, okay, that boy wasn't even born at that stage, so somewhere his dad probably had to sit during the week and say to him, yeah, you're playing against Johan Ackermann's son. You know that Johan Ackermann has used there, or what? You know what I mean? It's that.
Hey, Johan, they're probably still saying it now at the bottom of Rooks.
Yeah, but I mean, the reality is, it's sad to think that people that had to tell their children that if just to try and upset try and think they're going to make everyone negative about it. But but I mean, from a reputation point, I'm not shy about it, and it's a mistake, and I say you know, show me one person without a mistake. But the reality is that some people in the early part was judgmental, but over the years it went away. So I'm glad for that.
Excellent. Well, before I let you go, I mean, I couldn't possibly conclude this interview without pointing out that this weekend there is a Raw the big match. And I don't mean, is it Gloucester away at Leicester? I don't mean that one. I mean the one on Saturday morning. Have you got any thoughts on that? And will you be supporting England for an easy life, or are you going to be fully behind South Africa?
You know what, JB, I have to... With my whole heart, I have to support South Africa, and it will mean a lot for the country, and it is, the country is going through a difficult stage, and always will. So just for the spirit of the country and stuff, it will be great. What Rassie has done for the team in the last 2 years, you look at, my wife is at the moment in South Africa, and she said it's all going to be green, and they've opened up the whole, the pay TV has agreed that the national TV broadcasters can show the game as well. So it's going to be massive. So therefore, I really will hope. But my brain feels this is one that England probably can win. They played, if they can reproduce the performance they did against New Zealand, they... to me, it was just the more all round. There was tactical kicking. There was good running rugby. There was good defence. Where South Africa probably won against Japan and against Wales with probably because they only had a good scrum and a good maul. So that's a bit of a worry. Unless there's something else that they can produce that catch England off guard, but. I won't mind, and I say this not to cover myself, but I won't mind if the best team win, and on the day it's a dominant performance, and if it's England, they win, then fair by them. I'm just glad that South Africa is back on the top, and they play good rugby, because 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was really tough for the country to see the team struggle, so... They back up there, and as long as the team that win, that's my biggest hope, don't win with a controversial decision like a 50-50 penalty,
yeah.
that people say shouldn't have been, or a yellow or a red card or something like that,
Well, I it'll be interesting to see. I don't think anyone's challenged England physically yet. I think the Springboks will. And it'll be interesting to see what England do if they can't get front football, because they rely on it so much.
So I agree with you 100% there. I think that's the one thing that England hasn't experienced, is that physical challenge. I felt New Zealand was very soft on the tackle. So, so time will tell. But, Eddie and the whole team has done an amazing job.
Out of interest,
as well.
Out of interest, not to second guess your countrymen there. How would you set up this team? Would you go with an extra lock in the back row, or basically put out the most physical team you could?
Yeah, I think Rassie will stay with the same 23 and only bring Cheslin Kolbe back in. I can't see him change his formula now by not having Franco Mostert and Francois Lowe and Ergis Neyman on the bench. It's obviously a little bit of a risk on the back line if you pick up one or two injuries, but at the moment with the versatility that they've got with Francois Steyn that covers everything from 10 right through to 15, and Cheslin Kolbe who can cover 15, I think they're fine. Therefore, I do believe he'll stick with that pack that's big, and then he'll bring... You think... The only thing I'm waiting to see is, will he start with Beast and Bongi and Malherbe, or will he start with Kitsoff and Koch and Malcolm, because they're the stronger front row, but does he want them to come on second half and try and get penalties, or does he want to start with his best front row and try and put pressure from the beginning?
It's not a bad problem to have, is it?
No, not at all.
Not at all. Well, Johan, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I wish you all the best with Gloucester, and hopefully one day we'll be seeing you coaching international also, whether that be South Africa or elsewhere. But best of luck, and thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the chat, JB, and all the best. Hopefully see you soon.
Yes, take care.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.